I chose this story for one sentence.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, Peter Orner and I discuss the story Gomez Palacio by Roberto Bolaño. This is a story selected by Peter for this episode. It's a curious choice, but not altogether surprising, as it seems to be a favorite story for aficionados of Bolaño stories. But then again, sometimes it seems like my favorite Bolaño story is the one that I happen to be reading. In Gomez Palacio, an unnamed protagonist is far from home in the country of Mexico, specifically the town of Gomez Palacio, where he's staying briefly to conduct writing workshops with a handful of students, none of whom he seems terribly impressed with. The friend, Montero, is mentioned, but we don't know a lot about him except that he works for the arts council that helped the main character find this gig, and we can also assume that he's someone who sort of understands the protagonist's temperament. A character we do see is the director of the arts council. She's described, candidly, as plump and other ways that aren't so flattering, maybe only honest and tactless. But this is the way the protagonist sizes up everyone, including his young charges. The director picks up the writer every single morning in a boat of a sky blue car. They sit together and have coffee, and she tells him that her husband doesn't seem to understand the life of the writer. His perspective is how sad everything seems, how terrible. He thinks that he's, quote, confusing sense with sensitivity. He has trouble sleeping. He has nightmares. He also includes odd details about being very thirsty. His solution is to drink water, but then having to get up to go to the bathroom becomes a problem. I mean, everything is just kind of awful. No solutions. Not anywhere. But think about this. How is it that if things are so awful back then when he was 23, all these small moments of things he considers with disdain, why have they become such deep memories recalled with, yes, a tactlessness, but wrapped around a wistfulness too, and a beauty that he finally gives over in a very particular way to Gomez Palacio? Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Gomez Palacio by Roberto Bolaño.
I hope you don't mind Bolaño again. You mind?
Oh, no, I love it. But I do want to ask you why you chose this story.
I chose this story for one sentence, and I'll read it. It's such a wonderful sentence that as soon as I read the sentence, I realized this was going to be one of my favorite stories. Is it Bolaño's masterpiece? No, but it has this line. The line that I knew I would take with me for a long time, if not ever, is this. Meanwhile, I chain-smoked Bali cigarettes, looking out the window at the highway and thinking about the disaster that was my life. I was just like, right there. I felt like I was sitting there with this guy, and that I was looking out the window with him at the disaster that was his life and my life and so many lives that carry on. And it's not really a disaster, but you feel it is in the moment. You know, so many times when you're like, you look up and you think about what you are doing in a given moment and you think, oh, how did I get here? How did this happen? You know what I mean? I mean, so many examples. I think almost like everything I write is based on this kind of example. Like, how did I end up here in Gomez Palacio teaching a writing workshop and at breakfast with the Arts Council poet in some little town in northern Mexico that I don't want to be in? How did this happen to me? So, yeah, and I read that. And I was like, all right, I'm in forever.
I like this idea about how it's in that moment when he's 23 years old. And the first graph is so good for a lot of reasons that are probably very obvious to anybody. But I went to Gomez Palacio during one of the worst periods of my life. I was 23 years old, and I knew that my days in Mexico were numbered. And you don't necessarily need to know why his days in Mexico are numbered, except you know that he's not from there and he'll be leaving this country and going somewhere else. And also, it's during a very difficult period in his life, and he's only 23. And you learn all of these things, and there's still a lot of mystery in it. Like, who is this guy? And the very next thing is about the friend and about the idea that there's a prospect for a job there for him. But he first has to do all of these other things and tour all these other places. He says, I knew that I wouldn't stick to running a writing workshop in some godforsaken town in northern Mexico. So by the end of the second graph, we already know what he's not going to be doing. But there's more story to come. And so, you know, we're sort of all in to try to see what the story is.
And Bolaño is he realized something. Here I go being hyperbolic once again. But he realized something, I think, that's quite extraordinary. And that is that the world of literature beneath the splashy stuff that is on the national level of a given country is actually the country's literature, a given country's. So in Mexico, he meets, and all over his work, he's constantly encountering writers who aren't known by most people, you know, who are either working at a regional level or whatever. And I feel like he has so much love and affection and sometimes shame for being a part of that. Of course, he, you know, Bolaño personally became, you know, a mega rock star. But I think most of his life, he was very much unknown, struggling, and akin. He had a great deal of kinship with people who love this and they love to do it, but maybe aren't going to be rock stars ever. I think that this story is a wonderful example of him mining that territory.
It is interesting, the idea of the outsider and the isolation that's so, the artifice of it that's set up, because we know that he's not from this place. And not just that, you know, he's a writer and sort of always sort of, how do I say this, in his mind, but outside of his body a little bit. It's just an interesting way to set up the story, but it is a very Bolaño way to set up the story. But this guy is just like hammering at what is so terrible and wrong. I mean, at first it's a little bit tiring. Like, he doesn't like anything. I love this. In spite of the heat.
Judgmental.
Yeah. Judgmental about a small town, for sure. And that's a Bolaño thing, too, of the character. That's a Bolaño character thing. But in spite of the heat, I couldn't stop shivering. I like this line because it just shows, like, he's just like... he'll never belong there. You know, he's just sort of saying he can't survive there. He's not set up to survive there. And his choice of details around all the places he's been in Mexico. He's been all over. And suddenly we're at this pinpoint with Gómez Palacio, and we don't even know this guy's name or very much about him, but we are taking everything that he says. We are accepting everything that he says. But I know you don't like this term, but it's like the unreliable narrator. The more he talks, the more he says things. So without saying them, we're understanding what he isn't saying. We're understanding what he's not able to, except we're not understanding necessarily what he's able to say, because some of it is so beautifully mysterious. But we're understanding that some of what he's saying, we're not buying. And that's part of it.
Maybe I want to take back some of the nasty things I've said about unreliable narrator as a concept over the years, because I just realized something in what you said. It's maybe the concept of unreliability comes from within, not from without. Like, he's not reliable to himself, you know. It's not that he's lying to us. It's that he's not in any position to know any better. So he says what he says. I'll take that definition of unreliability, especially here. I guess what I'm saying is that he didn't know as a kid, as a punk kid who's trying to be a poet, but also trying to make a dime. He didn't know how rich his experience in this town was going to be. course he couldn't know. How could he know? He's living in a motel and all he wants to do is get the hell out of there. But the fact is that this is, I feel like this is like foundational in this character's life. And you know, by extension, you know, the writer himself.
Yeah.
He would have had no way of knowing that.
No, I was just going to say, you know, if you look up the definition of unreliable narrator in some of these, you know, textbooks or whatever, it will say that it's a narrator that lies. But I always take the approach of all the narrator has is the story and is giving us that story. It's up to the reader to decide where the narrator is lying to himself, where the narrator is misinformed or misguided or in denial or ignorant. That's a, for me, that's a very rich playground. Like, that's a very rich space to work in. So I love the idea of him saying, this is terrible. It's awful. It smells bad. It's so ugly. And the whole time I'm just busy as a reader trying to figure out what is going on beyond the fact that he's very young and a little bit conceited or something's going on. There's definitely something going on that's just beyond a self-centeredness. That's too easy. Because there's such a richness in the details that I feel like, wow, well, for somebody who detests this place, you sure noticed a lot of kind of cool stuff, you know, kind of beautiful things. So that, you know, I do come back to this idea of in that moment, to use your phrase, in that moment, yes, he was young. There were other priorities. There were other pressures. And that's all coloring how he's giving the story to us. But very clearly, it's very clear that years have passed. And I like to look at this line where he says, maybe I yelled, go fuck yourself. And the driver saw or heard me. But it's unlikely, like most things in this story. In any case,
yeah.
When I think about the driver, all I can see is my own image frozen in his rearview mirror. My hair is still long. I'm thin, wearing a denim jacket and a pair of awful oversized glasses. And then you look at that and you say, oh, the years have passed. And he's telling us the story in that particular period of 23 years old, in this particular context in Gomez Palacio, where, you know, he has a very tough job, I think, for someone so young.
That line you read about when he says fuck you to the car is so pivotal, where he basically says things could happen that didn't happen. I feel like there's like this incredible like pulling back. Like it's when a fiction writer decides, you know what, I'm not going to overdo it here. I'm just going to let this story be as sad and pathetic as it probably really was in real life and not have some big blow up with the husband who's driving the other car. And I thought, like, damn. Again, I just feel like there's so, you know, I mean, he's got so many, you know, when you talk about Bolaño, it's a little bit of the Dennis Johnson problem. It's a little bit like he's too cool sometimes, you know, in terms of like the readers and the way they talk about him, you know, like, oh, man, you know. Roberto Bolaño, man, oh my God, that guy's awesome. It's that kind of, you don't even realize how kind of sad and pathetic and great this work can be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that was the territory he mined. Patheticness.
I would like to do an inventory of all the stories where the narrator does something like that. I don't know if it happened quite this way. I mean, I'm not sure it happened like that, but let's, you know, there have been stories even we've covered on this podcast where the author does that. They all escape me at the moment, but I know we encounter it. And I just think that Bolaño in this story is a master class in how to do it in this story.
It's such a human, you know, kind of, you know, we've all been there kind of way. That's why the story I felt like when I first read it, and for some reason I've been carrying around his stories for years, but you know, there's always something that you miss, you know, and I either hadn't read this before or overlooked it somehow from some of the more, you know, the more famous stories that are more gothic or however you want to call it. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean? That are, you know, more frightening, more using more effects. You know, he doesn't need any effects in this story.
He
it's
doesn't.
just that it's he's driving around with a poet who's in love with a singer, her friend, her old friend. It's just the whole thing's just so sad and wonderful. I don't know. Are we doing the story justice?
I don't know, but I love the story. You know, it's called Gomez Palacio. You know, Palacio means palace. And he gives the story the name of the place that is so terrible because it's not so terrible. And it's
right.
very important. So there's something very mysterious about this guy that he's not going to give us about his past, about himself. We know just enough. We do know that he's very, you know, morose. The mood of the story, people always write about Bolaños, the mood of Bolaños' work and how good he is at setting up the mood and maintaining, sustaining the mood. There's a desert even. And then, you know, when you hit the element of the desert, you're sort of like, oh, that's such a barren landscape. Like, what's he going to do with the desert? Like, even the director's dress, even though he's not trying to describe it as being very beautiful, I'm reading it and I'm like, that's a cool dress. It has almost all of the state's native flowers on the print. But I'm like, what's he going to do with the desert? And of course, what does he do with the desert? The most incredible thing, because he's a poet also. But because it's not that bad a place. It is terrible at 23. It is absolutely the worst. But when you're mining, the worst things that have ever happened to you as a writer, years on, you have a different perspective. You have the same perspective, but a different perspective too. I don't know. The kids were still zombie-like.
Totally.
the writer kids were still zombie-like.
Yes. Let's get to the, I mean, you know, he captures, I mean, there's absolutely, there's nothing about poetry itself in here. It's about poets. And there's nothing about actually teaching writing, which is wonderful. But there is this paragraph where he says, one afternoon at the writing workshop in Gomez Palacio, a boy asked me how I came to start writing poetry and how long I thought I would go on doing it. The director wasn't present. There were five other people in the workshop, the five students, four boys and a girl. You could tell from the way they were dressed that the two of them were very poor. The girl was short and thin, and her clothes were rather garish. The boy who asked the question should have been studying at a university, instead of which he was working in a factory, the biggest and probably the only soap factory in the state. Another boy was a waiter in an Italian restaurant. The remaining two were at college, and the girl was neither studying nor working. By chance, I replied. For a while, none of us said anything. It's so great right there, right? Mm-hmm. I considered the possibility of taking a job in Gomez Palacio and staying there for the rest of my life. That's what he's doing in that pause after, by chance, I replied. And then he says, I had noticed a couple of pretty girls among the painting students in the yard. With a bit of luck, I might have been able to marry one of them. The prettier one, who also seemed to be more conventional. He's just like, his mind's wandering at this point. Finally, he answers the question. I could have said anything, but opted for simplicity. I don't know, I said. And then there's this, what about you? And the kid says, I started writing because poetry sets me free, sir. And I'm never going to stop, he said, with a smile that barely hid his pride and determination. As an answer, it was too vague and declamatory to be convincing. Yet somehow it gave me a glimpse of the factory worker's life, not as it was then, but the life he had led at the age of 15 or maybe 12. I saw him running or walking through the outskirts of Gomez Palacio under a sky that looked like a rock slide. I saw his friends and wondered how they could possibly survive, yet one way or another they probably had. It's just, it's hard to track this and describe it. I almost feel like he was in some kind of zone and he allowed the character's mind to wander while at the same time, you know, taking in the question and the answer and the kid saying, I am never going to stop. There's just something so gorgeous about that, even though the narrator completely disses it.
But that was the narrator at that age, you know. That's why he's 23 in here, because he once had that same feeling about poetry. And so yeah. when he says, I saw him, oh, he says, it was too vague and declamatory to be convincing, yet somehow it gave me a glimpse of the factory worker's life. Not as it was then, but as it had been when he was 15 or maybe 12. I saw him running or walking through the outskirts of Gomez Palacio under a sky that looked like a rock slide. That's poetic. I saw his friends and wondered how they could possibly survive. Yet, one way or another, they probably had. You know, it is showing like how did you end up here by chance? And then, what about you? Like this, and he's really telling him back his own story, maybe close to it. Then we read some poems. The only one who had any talent was the girl. But by then, I wasn't sure of anything. There's another moment there. By then, I wasn't sure of anything. Why is it so easy for him to say this poor guy who's in love with poetry and so hardcore about it, no, I'm not going to like your stuff. You know, it's a very human, sort of a human nature, I think, to do that.
I don't know. There's something about the way that he dismisses not only the work of these kids, but also his own judgment. It just, the whole thing, again, it's just so, so realistically pathetic. And yet, it's a celebration of loving poetry, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. He's just telling the story about a time when he was 23. So for the unreliable narrator, I mean, he's being very honest about it. We're doing exactly that. Like we go there where he's telling us this and we take what he's telling us and we figure out maybe something different than what he's directly saying. And that's so beautiful with Bolaño, because this is not just some guy who was down on this little Mexican town and dissing everything in sight. And just so unhappy guy that is, you know, complaining about everything. And he's so negative. And that's, period, the end of the story. That's not it at all. And we know this for a fact because when we get to the end of the story, we know this for a fact. This was just a very bad trip or period in his life. Or he was, you know, this angry young man or who knows. We don't know and it doesn't matter. It doesn't, right. That part doesn't matter
doesn't
at all.
Matter. Mm-hmm. Right, right. Not only doesn't it matter, it's sort of not what the story is. The story is hard to track. You know, like if we were to sort of like to kind of say like, okay, all right, so all right, at the end of this, like what's the story even getting at or what's it about? And I think the story is all about this weird car ride that he takes with the director, who again is a dedicated poet. She loves this. She's had a poetry collection published by the Regional Arts Council, you know, in town. And this is her life. Her husband doesn't understand it. Maybe her country singing friend does. And also maybe this random guy who washes up in town to teach a workshop. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, I go back to the genius of him realizing that this was rich material, you know, and not a death sentence that he thought at the time.
Yes.
It's a gold mine of stuff that he, who would have realized that? That's what he teaches us, at least one of the things. He's like, open your fucking eyes and realize where you are, even when if you think you're nowhere.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Why do you think there is this sort of interlude about the friend with the cassette in the car? Why do we need to know this about the director?
Because it's just so, so sad and great. And just like, of course, that, you know, like this is the one thing that this woman, you know, you could say it represents some like escape that she's not able to make, obviously. But also just like this is her, one of her poetic sources.
Okay, but I want to.
It's her friend.
I want to point to something right before that I just remembered.
I think it's a love story too.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you sure it was your husband? I asked as we sped off again toward the hills. No, the director said and started laughing. I don't think it was. I started laughing too. It's a little jarring that he's laughing as we, because of the way he's been this whole time, all mopey. The car looked like his, she said, almost choking with laughter, but it probably wasn't him. So it might have been, I said. Not unless he's changed his license plates, the director said, at which point I understood that the whole thing had been a joke. I shut my eyes. Then we came out of the hills and into the desert. A plane swept by the headlights of cars heading north or back toward Gomez Palacio. It was already night. Now we're coming to a very special place, the director said. Those were her words. Very special. And then it goes. But I just love this part about the joke. Because at first I'm like, you know, when you read the story, especially the first time you read the story, you're like, what, why is this here? And then you just trust and you keep reading. And I don't know if I know why it's there, but I know it enriches the experience for me. But I don't know. But the thing about the friend that comes right after, so we know some stuff about the husband that's a little bit implied, and then suddenly she's talking about this friend that she really, really loves.
I think, like, you're pointing out the idea of the why is the friend in it is so just such a wonderful question, because, you know, she's on a cassette singing, you know, and it's just, and they're listening to it. It's just the whole, I don't know. I guess I just keep returning to this idea again and again of, like, when you find yourself in a situation where you thought you'd never be, and there you are, and that's your life, and you look, you know, and it's a disaster. And somebody's playing the cassette of their friend who's, you know, trying to be a country star. It's just like, what?
But you know what, for me, in the story, I marked a couple of places where she is sharing. She is sharing something so personal, so very special. Those were her words, very special. The whole thing about cleaning the inside of the window and all that. But, you know, she shares with him the most beautiful things that she has, things you can't buy. She is sharing.
Yes, absolutely.
And she's
right.
And she doesn't even say, I'm a poet, you know, I'm a writer. She says, right. I know you'll forgive my eccentricities. After all, we both read poetry. I love that line. She's not saying.
I love that he's grateful. Sorry, go ahead. Because it's so great. What follows?
Yeah. Okay. What follows? Oh.
Well,
I was grateful she hadn't said we were both.
They were both poets.
Yeah, we're both poets. But yes, for many reasons. I think that would have really upset him at age 23.
Right.
For reasons we might not like, I'll just say that. But it's so good. So the whole interlude with her, the way she shares with him, and the way I see it, when you get to the end, where he says she was gone at the end, you really do have the sense, without even knowing for sure, that they never saw each other again. But she gave him some very special things. She shared with him some very special things. He shared nothing. She gave him something so special. And I feel like the mere fact that this is what he's recalling years on is showing something about how this terrible moment, the worst period of his life, you know, the whole thing about how awful this period was in this place. Now, I don't want to say anything too stupid and corny, but it is this idea of, I don't even know how to put it into words. I don't know how to put it into words. Because we haven't even said the most special thing, but she shares so much with him. Even the joke, there's like loss and hope and love and promise in this thing about the friend. And creativity and passion. There's this laughter and humor. There's poetry, obviously. They eat together and they drink a lot of coffee. She makes him drive. You know, she makes him drive.
He's never right, and he's never driven before. It's just sort of tossed in there.
She gives him.
He doesn't need to learn. He just drives.
She gives him so much. She gave him so much. And so when you're like, what is this? Why is she talking about her friend? And you almost have to walk away from the story in order to think back on it and see her as not just an incidental person that was, guiding him around, hosting him or whatever. She gives him so much. It makes me a little emotional to think about her a little bit, the director. But she was
right.
It goes back
to what you said earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to what he didn't realize it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't pretend that he realizes it even now. You realize it. He still doesn't really. Except you wouldn't know it if he hadn't told you this. Right.
So
But
years later,
getting it.
But years later, he's telling us the story, and he's the one giving it to us. He's sharing it with us. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that brings us to the end, which is also, does land exactly where you are. In spite of the fact that he doesn't get it, his older self looking back does get it.
What is the special place? Can we talk about that? Do you want to talk about that now? I wanted you to see this, she said proudly.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She pulled over and stopped in a sort of rest area, although it was really no more than a patch of ground big enough for trucks to park on. Lights were sparkling in the distance, a town or a restaurant we didn't get out. The director pointed in the direction of something, a stretch of highway that must have been about 5 kilometers from where we were, maybe less, maybe more. She even wiped the inside of the windscreen with a cloth so I could see better. I looked. I saw the headlights of cars. From the way the beams of light were swiveling, there must have been a bend in the highway. And then I saw some green shapes in the desert. Did you see? Asked the director. Yes, lights, I replied. The director looked at me. Her bulging eyes gleamed, as do, no doubt, the eyes of small mammals native to the inhospitable environs of Gomez Palacio in the state of Durango. Then I looked again in the direction she had indicated. At first, I couldn't see anything, only darkness, the sparkling lights of that restaurant or town. Then some cars went past, and the beams of their headlights carved the space in two. And then they see this sort of miraculous thing with the lights, which really most likely is caused by some sign reflecting the headlights. But this kind of stuff happens in the desert. You know, I think of like the Marfa lights, you know, like things happen, you know, and things are unexplainable, at least, or you want them to be unexplainable. And it's this, she shows him, like you said, this is the thing. This is the great gift that she wants to show him.
Yeah. And the next part is very beautiful, but maybe people should find the story and read the next part.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's where I think, because it's one of those stories, I like all the stories we do, really, but you need to, it isn't discussable, even though we try to discuss it, and I think that's why we do what we do. We discuss things that shouldn't be discussed in order for them to be read.
Correct. But I will say, I do like this when he knows he's going to leave the next day. I was to leave for Mexico City the next day. When we got back to the motel, the director got out of the car and walked with me part of the way. Before we got to my room, she held out her hand and said goodbye. I know you'll forgive my eccentricities, she said. After all, we both read poetry. There's that part. Once they say goodbye, and then it says he takes off his jacket and drinks water straight from the tap and goes to the window. Her car was still in the parking lot. I opened the door and was hit in the face by a gust of desert air. The car was empty. A little farther off, beside the highway, I saw the director, who looked as if she were contemplating a river or the landscape of another planet. The way she was standing, with her arms slightly raised, she might have been talking to the air, or reciting, or playing statues, like a little girl. You know what I love about that? Besides the fact that he makes something out of nothing, is that he compares her to a little girl. And whatever she is doing, I don't know what she's doing, but whatever she's doing, it puts me in the mind of the students, the young students who are like, I love poetry, sir. You know, the little girl still with a lot of hope about the future, not in a factory, maybe a poet, maybe something else. I don't know. There's just some weird kind of connection that I'm making. Maybe it doesn't mean anything and I'm reading too much into it, but I love it.
I think it's the heart of the thing. I think you nailed it.
Roberto Bolaño is the author of Gomez Palacio. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.